want to begin by stopping briefly to look at a couple encounters that Dante and Virgil have with souls on the terrace of Avaris. In Purgatory 19, we meet a pope. This is very important because, of course, in Inferno 19, we had the Simoniac pope with their feet flapping upside down. Here we meet an avaricious pope in Purgatory 19 who is, of course, in the process of purging himself from the sin of avarice. It's interesting that Dante sets up that parallel. But in the next canto, in Canto 20, Dante has another encounter in this terrace with the first Capetian king of France, Hugh Capet, a 10th century king. And in discussing how his family is turning out in Dante's day, he tells a story in which one of his descendants is involved in an attack on Pope Boniface VIII, Dante's nemesis in some way. Let me read you the lines. "The past and future crimes may seem as naught. I see the fleur-de-lis enter Alagna, the Italian city of Anagni, and in his vicar, Christ, made prisoner. I see the gall and vinegar renewed. I see him being mocked a second time, killed once again between the living thieves." Some of the bully boys of the French king actually rough up Pope Boniface VIII, and Boniface died shortly thereafter. And this is described as Christ being crucified again. We hardly think, from what we've heard so far, of Boniface as a Christ figure. And we know that Dante says that his final resting place will in fact be in hell. Nevertheless, as the vicar of Christ, to mistreat the vicar of Christ is in some way to mistreat Christ himself, to redo the crucifixion. It's another one of those reminders we said back at the beginning of our lecture in Purgatory, that perspectives are broadened and changed as we move through the purgatory. And at the beginning of Canto 21, we have another interesting image. It's another image of Christ that's invoked. Dante and Virgil are walking along when suddenly, just as we read in Luke that Christ, new risen from the tomb, appeared to the two men on the Emmaus road, a shade appeared. Well, that in itself is interesting. We have another Christ figure. It's even more interesting because it turns out to be a Roman poet named Statius.
Well, it's kind of weird that you would have a Roman poet being introduced by his likeness to Christ for openers. Even weirder is the fact that at the end of the last canto, there was a very interesting phenomenon. You know what an earthquake is? There was a mountain quake. The seven-story mountain quaked, and it turned out that it was quaking for joy. That's sort of the signal that a soul is ready to rise from one level to the next, to go up higher. And once again, the figure for whom this was done is the Latin poet Statius. Now, Statius is a poet who is not as much studied these days as he was in Dante's own time. He was certainly never somebody who had quite the reputation or the pizzazz that Virgil did, but nonetheless was recognized as one of the most important of the Latin poets. And so what we have is a really interesting group of folks now when you add Statius to Virgil and Dante, because one of the things that turns out to be particularly interesting is that Statius is not only sort of introducing himself here, but he's also going to hang with them for an awfully long time as they continue to go up the mountain. Statius himself is free. And so in the time that he's hanging with Virgil and Dante, we learn an awful lot about him. And this is one of those very interesting places where what was known about him from classical antiquity kind of combines with Dante's own poetic imagination. And Dante does sort of additions to Statius and his life, which are every bit as daring as what we saw him doing with Ulysses back in the Inferno.
Let's take a look at the story that he tells after the introductory remarks are over. During the time of the good Titus, this is the Roman Emperor Titus who ruled in the 80s AD, who, assisted by the King of Kings, avenged the wounds that poured forth blood which Judas sold. Before he was emperor, he had, in fact, conquered and sacked Jerusalem. I bore the title that endures the most and which is honored most, the soul replied. Renown I had, not yet the Christian faith. And he tells about his poetic career and then says, the spark that kindled my poetic ardor came from the sacred flame that set on fire more than 1,000 poets. I mean the Aeneid. And he goes on to say, and if only I could have been alive when Virgil lived, I would consent to spend an extra year of exile on the Mount. Virgil was his inspiration. Virgil was his poetic model. Now, he doesn't know that he's saying this to Dante and Virgil.
So you have this wonderful dramatic scene. Virgil was my guy. He's there with Virgil. Well, are they going to be able to keep this as a secret? It turns out that Dante is unable to. The surprise, the joy at the situation. Hey, I get to unite these two famous poets is a little bit too much. Virgil turns to Dante. His look told me in silence, silence. Okay, we don't want to give this away, but the power of a man's will is often powerless. Laughter and tears follow so close together. The passions that provoke them, the more sincere the man, the less they obey his will. So now he's sort of given something away, and Virgil says it's okay to give the rest away. And so Dante turns to Statius and says the following. You seem to find my smiling very strange, I said to him, O ancient spirit. But I have to tell you something stranger still. The shade here, who directs my eyes to heaven, is the poet Virgil, who bequeathed to you the power to sing the deeds of men and gods. Well, once again, that idea that we mentioned earlier on, that in purgatory, it's a place full of surprises, and the surprises turn out to be good ones. I mean, Statius is saying, boy, more than anything else in the world, I'd love to be able to meet this guy Virgil, and there he is. Okay, so there's this wonderful surprise, and the way that he reacts is not surprising, because, you know, here he's met his idol, okay? Already he was bending to embrace my teacher's feet, but Virgil, brother, no, you are a shade. It is a shade you see. There's something inappropriate about here, in this part of the afterlife, one poet bending to do homage to another. So it's kind of interesting, then, that you have a situation where three great poets are now hanging out together, and there's a really interesting set of relationships in terms of the influence of one on another. We've already seen at the very beginning of the poem the way in which Dante has looked at Virgil as a model. Now we see Statius saying, hey, Virgil was my model too. So there's a kind of interesting way in which Statius then is sort of linked to Dante through their mutual respect and admiration for Virgil. And it's also interesting to see the way in which Statius has taken from Virgil something rather different than what Dante does.
Now, up to this point in the story, there's nothing new in the sense that what we're told about Statius in Purgatory 21 is stuff that was generally known about Statius. As we move to Canto 22, we get, if you will, the rest of the story. And it's quite a striking story. But before the story continues, a little pause in the action to ask Statius a question. You just said you spent 500 years on this terrace before this mountain quake occurred. Now, that was the terrace of Avaris. How could somebody like you, how could somebody that read Virgil's poetry, how did a smart guy like you be greedy? That seems like sort of a surprising thing for somebody like you. And he gives an explanation that sort of startles us. He said, well, that wasn't it at all. But there's the opposite sin from avarice, which is prodigality, of not valuing money enough, if you will. And that's what I was guilty of. And so as it turns out, these two opposites are punished on the terrace of wrath. Interesting, in Inferno 7, we have the wrathful and the prodigal in the same place crashing against each other. Here we have them in the same place, in a sense working commonly to be ready to move on beyond the terrace of wrath. Again, we go from confrontation to cooperation with both the avaricious and the prodigal.
Okay, so Statius continues his story. And it turns out that, you know, if what you got up until this point, you know, somebody going to, nowadays, let's say, to the Oxford Classical Dictionary and looking up Statius, it would kind of correspond. But here Dante the poet takes this very, very radical step and presents us with a very different Statius than the one of recorded history. He tells a little bit about his career and about the poems that he wrote and that he was famous for. One of the things I think that would be particularly important in our discussion is that for people in the Middle Ages, he was the most important source for the story of Thebes and all of the things that happened to Thebes. So that we saw that, for example, in looking at Ugolino and Ruggieri, that sort of compared to stuff that happens at the siege of Thebes. And so for that, he was an important poet, and like Virgil, a very important political poet. So again, the Statius of history would have that in common with the figure that is presented here. But Dante has a really interesting question about all of this, because there's no evidence from any of this that Statius was a Christian, even though he lived after the coming of Christ. He really, according to what everybody thought, had no particular knowledge of or interest in that kind of stuff. So this is the way in which the question is posed to him. From what you wrote in Clio's company, it does not seem that you were faithful then to that faith without which virtue is in vain. He's saying, how come you're here among the saved? This certainly seems to be against everything that we saw earlier, and of course, in particular, it's against everything that we've seen back there in Inferno 4, which is, of course, where Virgil himself has his permanent home. So, if it be so, tell me what heavenly sun or earthly beam lit up your course so that you could set sail behind the fishermen. And Statius has the most interesting answer you could possibly hope for as Dante presents this wonderful, wonderful story of conversion.
It was you directed me to drink Parnassus waters. No problem up to here. You inspired me as a poet. It was you, still speaking to Virgil, whose radiance revealed the way to God. My conversion to Christianity was started by you. And that you is Virgil, the pagan poet, who of course lived before the time of Christ and who has this permanent dwelling place in limbo. How can this be so? You were the lonely traveler in the dark who holds his lamp behind him, shedding light not for himself, but to make others wise. What Virgil knew was not enough to save him. But what Virgil did was, it's a wonderful image, sort of take his light and hold it behind him so that that light guides others who could go, therefore, farther than Virgil went himself. And the specific text that's pointed to is, in fact, not a text in the Aeneid, but rather a text in a poem called the Fourth Eclogue of Virgil. For you once wrote, quote, "The world is born again, justice returns, and the first age of man and a new progeny descends from heaven." A poem that historians today would say was probably written about the birth of an heir to the Emperor Augustus. But given the fact that Statius lived after the time of Christ, Statius could read that poem and find more in it than Virgil himself knew. And therefore, it was that began Statius turning toward God, began his conversion.
So you have Virgil accomplishing more for Statius than Virgil was able to accomplish for himself. a very interesting and important paradox. Now, we've already had reason to mention that there's a kind of connection between Statius and Dante, because, of course, both of them draw something from Virgil. This is sort of a shock to Virgil, needless to say, but again, it's sort of something that Dante himself has got to learn from. In other words, what Dante the poet is learning how to do in this journey is what Statius has already done. Take things in Virgil that go beyond the use that Virgil himself was able to make of them. And so what we have is Dante implicitly making the same kind of claim for himself and his own poetry as something that takes Virgil and goes beyond it. Again, in the structure of the poem itself, Virgil is Dante's guide, but only his guide so far, only his guide up to a point. And so this particular interchange between Dante and Virgil and Statius becomes particularly important because it's coming pretty close to the time when Virgil himself is going to leave, when Virgil is going to give over his guidance of the pilgrim to Beatrice. And so what we see here, I think, in this notion of Statius's conversion to Christianity is a preparation for the obsolescence of Virgil in the poem.
In many ways, this passage makes us go all the way back to the beginning of the poem, and it helps to answer some questions that perhaps perplexed readers at the beginning. Why would Dante have a pagan guide through the Christian afterlife? Why would there be a lot of references to pagan ideas, pagan philosophers, pagan poets, and whatever? Why would even much of the structure of hell be based on Virgil's description of the afterlife in the Aeneid, Book 6? I think at first that sort of puts off a lot of readers who wonder, isn't Dante just sort of freely mixing stuff because he's just trying to borrow the best pieces possible? But I think we can see now that we need the classical world as guides. We need to be able to read it differently than people living in that world read. We now have the advantage of reading it through the lens of the incarnation, the crucifixion, and the resurrection. But that new lens allows us to find more in those poems than the poets or the historical figures or whatever knew or were conscious of knowing was part of their own writing, their own lives.
Now, the journey continues. Again, it's important to keep in mind that now the journey is the three of them walking up together. That is to say, Virgil and Statius, as well as Dante. And interestingly enough, in the next several cantos, as we're heading to the final two circles, final two terraces that need purging, Dante runs into one after another of his own more immediate poetic predecessors. Okay, one way to take a look at it, of course, is that Virgil writes in Latin, but Dante makes the very important decision that he's going to write in Italian. Statius, as another Latin poet, learns from Virgil, and now what we have is Dante meeting a bunch of poets who wrote in Dante's own language, who lived in the generations before him, and who were some of them alive in his own time. And he has an encounter with all of these poets, and I think what we're meant to do is to sort of look at this very carefully and say, well, okay, what he sees in these poets is something about his own poetic career, but also he's going to have to look at these poets in much the same way that Statius has looked at Virgil, to take from them what is most valuable and to take from them what might even be beyond what they themselves realized they had. Okay? We have this remarkable series of encounters which sort of all add up to a kind of analogy between Dante and a group of vernacular poets and Statius and Virgil, going beyond, seeing more in them than they were aware, and seeing something in them also which needs to be Christianized.
Before we turn to the first one of those poets, I simply want to introduce him by pointing this out. It's a fellow named Forese Donati. and we meet him in Canto 23. What I want to suggest as a historian of this pair is that Forese, a member of the Donati family, first of all, the Donati family were the political enemies of Dante. They were the leaders of the Blackwells. Secondly, the Donati family is one of the very few families that has people in all three parts of Dante's afterlife. We met one in Inferno 25. We will meet another at the beginning of the Paradiso. So this is another one of those families, like the family of the Emperor Frederick II, that we want to sort of remember, because we can go back and sort of look at that family and learn things about family, as well as things about inheritance and so many other issues. So it's interesting, the first one that Dante chooses to have people this poetic heavy part of the purgatory is in fact a very careful choice, not just for poetic, but for other reasons as well.
Now, Frazi's no great poet. An analogy that might be a little bit far-fetched. I was talking the other day about the fact that my brother is a very, very good chess player, sort of ranked and all that kind of stuff. And somebody said, oh, you must have fun playing with him. I said, no, that's ridiculous. It would last him four moves and he would beat me. I taught him the moves of chess. He's younger than I am, but 8 years. But, you know, by the time that he had been playing the game for a couple of months, he could slaughter me, and I haven't played chess with him in 20 years. Essentially, Forese and Dante used to sort of exchange insult poems with each other. They were as sophisticated as sort of nice Italian rhymed versions of your mother wears combat boots sorts of things. And so it's kind of like this is how he got his start in the poetry biz, but don't expect to find a lot of Forese Donati poems in any anthology of Italian literature. But the interesting thing is that there they were talking to each other in this sort of shorthand code language. And at this point, all right, in purgatory, Forese says, you know, in fact, it was the love of a virtuous woman that enabled me to get as far as I am now in purgatory. Now, sort of good for my life, if not for my poetry. And they begin talking about the sort of degeneration of values and virtue in Florence, not surprisingly. But the way it continues, it seems pretty clear that this joking poetry that Dante and Forese exchanged when they were youths couldn't really deal with the seriousness of the issue that they bring up here in Purgatory. In other words, one of the limits of this early poetry is that it couldn't take into account any of the important societal or what we've been calling political issues of Florence or of Italy as a whole. And so what Dante is doing is going to these poets who start out very personally. That's what they want to talk about. But in the background is the model of the two great political poets, Virgil on the one hand and Statius, who has learned from him. And so while Dante is learning the kind of personal love part of his craft from the poets in the vernacular, he has to also learn the political part of his craft from Virgil, and now from the combo of Virgil and Statius.
We have then in the next canto, in Canto 24, a whole gathering, it seems, of poets. Again, folks who are very close in time to Dante. And this is a place where, among other things, we talk a great deal about style, because there was a great deal of stylistic development and innovation that ultimately began with the troubadour poets in southern France, sort of went in a particular form to Sicily, and then came to northern Italy. And therefore, there was not just discussion about the substance of poetry in Dante's time, but also the style, the best way of expressing what a poet wants to express. And it's here in Purgatory 24 that Dante meets a whole bunch of these fellows, and they talk, if you will, about both style and substance.
Yeah, and one of the ways it's done is that he meets this poet from Lucca, a guy named Buonaggiunta. And Buonaggiunta, by the way, we're still in the Terrace of the Gluttons, and you go from the Gluttons a little bit later to the last of the terraces, that of Lust. Buonaggiunta is talking about various poetic things and recognizes Dante, and recognizes Dante as somebody who is a guy who got it better than he did. Notice, of course, that's been prepared for by what we said about artistic pride and humility back there on the Terrace of the Proud. But he looks at Dante and he says, tell me, Do I not see standing here him who brought forth the new poems that begin, Ladies Who Have Intelligence of Love? Okay, so essentially what happens is that Buonaggiunta is quoting one of the lines from one of Dante's greatest hits, that is to say, one of his earlier love poems. And Dante, sort of, you know, trying to be somewhat modest, but also take credit for that, says, I am the one who, when love inspires me, takes careful note and then gives form to what he dictates in my heart. Okay, in other words, what Dante is doing is defining the poetic process there and essentially saying, you know, when Buonaggiunta says, you know, your thing is you knew the right way to talk about love, Dante says a little bit about this is how I do it. And so Buonaggiunta says, my brother, now I see the knot that held back Guittoni and the notary and me back from the sweet new style I hear. In other words, that explains why we weren't as good as you were. That we didn't, you know, we didn't get this love stuff right. But this is really tricky. I mean, remember, love of the sort that appears in this kind of poetry is the very thing that got somebody like, well, let's say, Francesca da Rimini in big trouble back in the Inferno. And so the question is this good or not? And the answer is, it really depends on the kind of love that you're talking about, the kind of love that Dante is following. And it seems to me that at this point, essentially what we're finding out is that if you think about it in terms of Dante's earlier poetry, it's love that could have gone either way. Right? And it seems like if you follow the example of Statius and Virgil, what Dante has to do is play Statius to his earlier predecessors and learn how to take that impulse for love poetry and somehow Christianize it in the same way that Statius Christianizes Virgil's political poetry.
It's also interesting, this fellow Guittone, whom Dante mentions here, is a guy who wrote a famous poem about Florence, a lament for Florence, after the Battle of Monteperti. And in fact, shortly after this discussion that we just talked about, we go back to talking about politics, because it's so important for us to remember that politics and poetry are not two separate activities. That one of the things that Dante needs to do, it seems to me, is to understand the highest calling of the poet, which is not only to talk about the things of the individual and the things of the heart, but also the way people as society operate together. And so the fact that Forese flashes back into a discussion of Florence, and the fact that Guittone was in fact a poet who wrote this sort of funny poem, if you will, not funny in the sense of humorous, about Florence's demise at Monteperti, reminds us of another quality that Dante needs to infuse into his poetry.
And the discussion continues. When they get to the next terrace, the terrace of lust, Dante meets some more of his poetic predecessors. In fact, one of the people he meets is the first Guido that we saw in Purgatorio 11, a guy named Guido Guinicelli, who sort of gave way to the second Guido, Guido Cavalcante. And he's here now, okay, as kind of a little bit of an MC for Dante, talking about the other folks who were there. He says, I can fulfill your wish. I am Guido Guinicelli, here so soon, for I repented long before I died. Now, it's interesting that we don't find out a whole heck of a lot about what his individual sins are, but remember, he's in the terrace of lust here, which means that part of what's going on might well be repenting of the tendency toward lust that's in the poetry itself. And here, his job seems to be to point out to Dante earlier poetic masters in the vernacular, okay, in the Romance European languages, going all the way back to the 12th century. And they're all here together in need of that same kind of purgation from the sin of lust. So what we have here at the end of this canto, what we have is a sort of conclusion to a movement that really started with Francesca in Inferno 5 that implicates Dante in a relationship with all of his previous poetic predecessors, and they all stand together in need of this purgation of the sin of lust.
And now, after Dante leaves this terrace, all seven P's, standing for the seven sins, are erased from his brow, and he's ready to enter the earthly paradise, and pretty soon, finally, to meet Beatrice.